What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that intersect and confront our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and joining me, I have Dr. Mignon Emenike. She's a pediatrician. Pediatricians often are primary care physicians who specialize in children. It's that branch of medicine that deals with the medical care of infants, children, and adolescents. The age range usually goes from birth to 18 or 21. This is a part of our Wrap with a Pro series, and it provides interested high school students enrolled in the Millicent Holyfield Academy of Health Sciences the opportunity to talk with a health professional. This hour, 411 Teen, features Dr. Mignon. And I have my student, you want to introduce yourself, who's often with me. I'm glad to have Holly.
Hey, it's nice to be here.
Yeah, she is a student at Rickards. Want to start off, or I'll start? What do you want?
You can start.
Dr. Mignon, share with us the training in pediatric medicine. Just what does it involve?
Well, first, it involves, of course, going from high school to your undergraduate four-year college program, typically. And I personally studied at Hampton University and studied molecular biology, so usually something in the sciences or biology departments. And then after that, you have to apply to medical school, and there's a big test that you have to take called the MCAT to get into medical schools. And then you go to 4 years of medical school, and after that, then you must do a three-year residency program that helps you to or allows you to specialize in pediatrics. And from there, you can decide if you want to be a specialist, a pediatric specialist.
So what was the hardest part of your schooling?
The hardest part, well, just the duration of the process itself. You know, so first you have a plan and you know that you want to go into medicine and you believe that you want to be a pediatrician. But first, of course, you got to do all the hard work to – you got to believe in yourself and do all of the hard work to get into medical school. And that's difficult as well. But just having the proper study habits to continue that process and path. And then, of course, residency is very difficult but very doable too. By the time you make it there, you're going to survive. Yeah.
What are some good schools to go to for pediatrics?
Well, that's the residency program. So like I say, first you have to start with your undergrad program and then go on to your medical school training. There's a lot of good programs. We have actually a new program. Florida State School of Medicine has been here for a little while now, but that's the newest medical school in the country, last I checked. But they are very strong. And then – of course, you're going to apply to your pediatric program. So there's a lot of great programs around the country, and there's a lot of wonderful programs in the Northeast as well.
Would you share the coursework that you took as an undergrad? I think she'd like to know about that. What does she need to major in? Does she have to go into sciences? Are they looking more into humanities or whatever? And as long as you meet the prerequisites and the requirements, talk a little bit about that, please.
Yeah. So as an undergraduate student, usually, like you say, it's pretty hardcore in the sciences. You know, you're talking chemistry, biochemistry, physics. Most people, but not all, it's not a requirement, but the majority of people have, you know, come from the science schools. And you also, of course, want to be a well-rounded person. You know, these days you can't just be a great student. You have to have maybe some experience volunteering or, you know, you'll have volunteers, high school volunteers perhaps at the hospitals or in the newborn units, which is a lot of fun to see, you know, people there. And it's a great exposure for the students. and you get to be in that environment, the hospital environment, and see both, you know, the babies in conjunction with their families, because you never see a child without their family usually. So those would be good things to do. And then, you know, anything else, like I say, there's research, potentially research opportunities or other sometimes volunteer in doctor's offices if you're able. But reaching out and having a broad base for your application when you finally submit that.
How do you volunteer to go work with the infants?
That you'd contact the hospital. So at our local hospitals, TMH and Capital Regional Medical Center, there must be a volunteer office. So and so you'd contact the hospital. So that would be a great thing to do, and people do that. Or the old candy, you know, what they used to call the candy stripers. You know, those people. You'll contact the hospital directly, and you'll inquire with them.
All right.
Yeah, but that's a wonderful thing to do.
Now, I know pediatricians have a number of different avenues they can travel. Would you share where pediatricians go? I mean, some are in clinical settings, some are in research. You know, talk to her about those options that one may pursue after they even become a pediatrician.
So you could be just a general pediatrician, which is, you know, your primary care doctor, the one who, like myself, who takes care of kids from birth. Like today I saw a 3-year-old baby in the office all the way up until they're, you know, 18 or 21, depending upon the office. And that's a great process because, you know, you really become important to these people. You're a part of their life, and you watch the children grow. There's nothing more satisfying for me than, you know, when my patients come in and the children, they know me. They're excited to see their doctor. Or if I go to the grocery store and see my kids in the, you know, in the grocery store, and they're, oh, Dr. Mignon, you know, hello. So that's really sweet and very, very important. And you can really have a big impact on people as they're growing and developing and encouraging them in different kinds of ways, and you become very important to the family. So that's very satisfying for me personally. Just like any other field of medicine, there are some people who want to not do everything and have that broad scope, but focus on certain things like pediatric neurology, which would be, you know, people who focus on seizures or headaches or other neurologic problems, or pediatric gastroenterology. We have, you know, the specialty of pediatric pulmonology, which is asthma and allergies and those types of things. So some people don't like to be quite as broad because as a general pediatrician, you have to be able to recognize and know a lot, have a very broad base, but that's just personal preference. And of course, for those people who want to go into those subspecialties, that is the fellowship after the residency, right? Mm-hmm. Another 3 years after you've done those 12 years of study before. And then there are some people who, you know, have MD, PhDs or want to be researchers. And so there's a variety of things that one can do. And I think it's really based upon, you know, your personal likes and goals, and you figure that out along the way. I think something that's really important is knowing that you don't have to know everything precisely the way that it's going to be. Nobody really knows exactly how your future is going to be. You just have to know that, oh, I'm interested in medicine. I think this is what I want to do. I'm going to start this path, and, you know, the rest of the process will unfold.
What are some good classes to take while you're in college to begin your career as a pediatrician?
Yeah, so those would be, you know, you have to take your basic biology classes. You have to take your these are the ones that I remember, okay? You have to take your chemistry class, which was difficult, and biochemistry class, which was difficult, but it's very interesting and fascinating because you find out all the answers to all these things that happen in the body or that we never really, you know, thought about or understood. And then, you know, there's, like I say, physics and calculus. You know, you have to take your math classes and your calculus classes. So it's pretty intense and pretty heavy.
I was just going to ask you, share with her just how important math and science overall are. And I think you pretty much touched on
it. Oh, yeah, it's crucial. You know, very, very, very important. And, you know, the one thing about math and the sciences is sometimes people get – well, usually the people who get interested in medicine and pediatrics are people who already have a natural tendency towards that, and that's mm-hmm. fulfilling for them, and they want to know the answers of the whys and the hows. But very, very important. And, of course, you know, that base starts now. In high school and even in middle school, you know, but working hard and consistently working on that. And even if you're interested in medicine but you find that calculus is difficult, or it wasn't easy for me either, but if you work at it hard enough, I always say the one good thing about math is that if you do it enough, you know, all it takes is practice and you mm-hmm. can always check the answer. So so that's very, very important. I can't stress it enough.
What about the cost?
Oh.
Well, that's an important part.
Yeah.
And those who are interested really need to know what pathway they're setting for.
Yeah. There is a cost. There's definitely a cost.
Financial cost.
Yeah. Financial mm-hmm. cost is what we're talking about. Can be intimidating, can be kind of scary. There are different scholarships for different, you know, for academics or different groups. And you can find some of those for sure. I don't know how many are out there now. I'm sure there's still a good number. I took advantage of that when I was an undergraduate student, but and it didn't cover everything. But I would say, you know, my advice is don't be intimidated or limit yourself because of cost. As a young person, big numbers with your name on it look scary, big loans. But this is an investment in your future, and this is a lifelong career, and you, whatever that cost is, if you have to pay back money, then you can do that over the years. And, you know, I've took care of it, and I'm all finished with those loans, but it took many years. Mm-hmm. There are state schools, and of course, in-state schools are less expensive than private schools. So there's government-funded schools or private schools, and those private schools can be very costly. Very costly. But don't let that stop you, or don't avoid your dreams because of the cost. You will make that money up and more.
Hold your thoughts for a moment. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, weekly program for teens. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and joining me is Dr. Mignon Umenike. She is with the Health and Wellness Center of North Florida, and Holly Berger, student at Rickert High School and the Millicent Holyfield Academy of Health Sciences, is here to talk about and find all out about pediatrics or pediatrician. This is our special Wrap with a Pro series. It provides students interested in various health fields an opportunity to talk with a health professional. Dr. Mignon, I had to interrupt you. I guess you were still talking a little bit just about the cost and not to let it be overwhelming is what I got the feel from.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that was the main point, was that when you're young and you have to sign off on loans, if your family may not, you know, most people can't afford to cover it all for their children, and that is okay. And you have to take responsibility for yourself, and you will be able to take care of those loans and that kind of debt. So I just encourage people to be open-minded and not fearful.
Okay. Holly, too.
When you were talking about that, it made me think about something my friend had told me about, a place called Job Corps. Can you tell me what you know about that?
Job Corps, I don't know if it provides scholarships. That I don't know a whole bunch about, but it would be worth looking up. I do know that Job Corps is a great, I believe it offers great opportunities for work and experience and learning. And I believe there's usually a 2-year commitment or something like that. But in terms of scholarship money, I'm not so sure. You have to check that out yourself.
because she had mentioned, I told her I wanted to be a pediatrician or a gerontologist, and she mentioned that if you go to Job Corps, they will help you become an RN with, you can live there and take your classes there, and they give you food and everything's completely free, is mm-hmm. what she told me. So just like with all the costs and everything, I was wondering about that.
Wow, that sounds great. Yeah, definitely something worth looking up. There are certain federal funded programs that reimburse you, you know, higher salaries or different stipends and bonuses if you work in underserved areas. And we have some we have underserved or rural communities, you know, mm-hmm. just down the street mm-hmm. in Quincy, or, you know, it's not that far away, or Perry. And those people, you know, there's special programs that encourages people to go work there, and they give you more money to help you repay those loans. Mm-hmm. So there are other opportunities, definitely. And again, like I say, just because I don't talk about them doesn't mean that they're not there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they do exist. There are opportunities. And when you don't find those other opportunities for payment, like I say, just don't be fearful. Don't not commit to your dreams that you are, you know, things that you know that you can do or you want to do. Follow that path. Don't be deterred by that, because this is an investment and you're going to get a good job and you'll be able to take care of it.
Share with her, Dr. Mignon, some of the allied health professionals that you interact with on a regular basis.
Oh, yes. Well, there's many, you know, and actually mm-hmm. you'd mentioned nursing, but there's many different levels. So, one can become a pediatrician, but there's also, you can become a physician assistant, which is it's a faster path, but it is what we call mid-level providers. So there's nurse practitioners, which we have two programs in Tallahassee that trains and puts out nurse practitioners. We have physician assistants, which we don't have a program here in Tallahassee. But they are what we call mid-level providers. So they're practitioners that function very much like doctors in some ways, but with their duration of training is not as long, and there are some things that they cannot do. But those are also good opportunities, and that's interesting. And then, of course, you know, there's the nursing field. You have, you know, respiratory therapist, all sorts of, you know, LPNs as well, different levels of providers and care.
What does mm-hmm. a nurse practitioner mostly do?
That's interesting. I have nurse practitioners in my office, and they see and manage patients. And they write prescriptions as well. There are certain prescriptions that they can't write. So there are certain prescriptions that have to have the doctor's signature. But they work by my side taking care of patients as well. If they might take care of a slightly less, the higher levels of acuity, or the sicker the patient, you know, it'd be more important that I see those patients. Mm-hmm. But they take care of we take care of a lot of the very same things. And like I say, the training's a little faster, although you have to become a nurse first, and then you get your nurse practitioner degree. But, you know, they like I say, they're called mid-level providers. They sort of fill that gap. There's not enough doctors out there. Going into medicine, it's a great time to go into medicine. There's a lot of need. There's a lot of patients, and there's not a lot of doctors. There's actually a shortage of doctors. So going into healthcare and whatever – you know, aspect that you go into it's a great opportunity. There'll be work and opportunity. So that's something to think about. That's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Dr. Mignon, in dealing with children, how do you know what's wrong? I mean, they can't talk. They can't verbalize and tell you, oh, my back hurts or my throat is sore. So what are the indicators? How do you know something is going on with a child?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a difficult thing. That's what keeps some people out of going into pediatrics, is that they, you know, they find it difficult to deal with patients who can't speak, and you have to read those signs and symptoms. And that's all about the study. You know, that's why we go to medical school and we do our pediatric rotations, and you find out what are the common pediatric illnesses.
That's my next question.
Exactly. So you have to, So you have to know those things so that you know what you're looking for. You know, the truth is, you know, most kids are healthy, but there are sick kids. And our goal is to keep our eyes out, especially for the bad things that are really going to hurt them. And, you know, that's all the study in the background. So knowing the really bad things that will cause stomach pain or fever or diarrhea or the things that – the uncommon things that you have to really look for.
What do parents – at what point – I mean, is there a general rule of thumb that you share with parents as to when to come to the doctor? You know, otherwise they may be running every 5 minutes. I mean, are there things – are there indicators that you would – could share that may help them and just – wondering how severe is this?
Yes. Well, the truth is that, you know, not only are we, as a pediatrician, not only are you treating the patient, mm-hmm. but you're treating the family, the parents. Mm-hmm. So you really get to know them as well. And there are some people who, you know, there's common cold, and there's some people who will come in for a fever or want to come in twice a week, you know, and at some point it becomes a little excessive, or maybe you can't do that all the time. So that just requires getting to know the family and also providing education and support and access. And, you know, there are some folks that I will see more frequently because it's necessary for not just for the, you know, for the health of the baby, but the baby might be fine. But for the health of the family, mm-hmm. you know, the mother or the father. Yeah. And every opportunity that, you know, the patient comes in, it's not just about sickness. Again, you're mm-hmm. learning about their family dynamics. Who lives at home? You know, are there pets at home? Do you smoke? What happened to, you know, oh, your husband lost his job, or, you know, those financial stresses. So it's very, very important. And it just gives us every opportunity that we come together. It's just another opportunity to really get to know these people, and that's what happens, and that's why it's very fulfilling. You know, you really become an important component to the patients and to their kids and to their. I take care of adults as well, so not only will I take care of the kids, but I'll take care of mom and dad, and by that time, I really know what's happening mm-hmm. in their family mm-hmm. dynamic. So, mm-hmm.
I'm thinking. Also, like about, say, at what point, let's say a baby has a fever, mm-hmm. when do they need to bring that baby in?
Specifically,
yeah.
something like that.
Yeah, yeah, something like that.
Well, you know.
And I know there's variation there.
Yes,
but
there's
variation. Just give me kind of general.
Yeah,
rule
I'd say, you know, if the temperature is greater than, you know, 101 or 102, or it's persistent, mm-hmm. or again, it's a constellation of symptoms. It's mm-hmm. not just one thing. And that's how we figure out how sick is this person, you know, what's really wrong
they're
with them.
They're having diarrhea continually
yeah.
as opposed
to. Yeah, exactly. Or, kind of, the baby's pulling at the ear as well. Well, then you need to come in. You, unfortunately, I always say, you know, you can't look in their ears, so it's okay. Come to the office. You know, if they have an ear infection, we need to treat it. And, you know, we have to have special equipment to do mm-hmm. that. Or a cough, or if there's signs or symptoms of, you know, breathing difficulty. And so when patients do come, you know, we try to educate them on, even if it turns out to be a common cold, I always tell, you know, these are the worrisome signs or symptoms that you're going to need yeah. to look for. You know, if the baby's breathing too fast, or, you know, there's nasal flaring, you know, so I educate them so they know, you know, this time it's okay, but, you know, if it gets worse, or if it changes, or if it doesn't get better, so giving those guides, then you need to come back to me and just call me and come back. And we always err on the side of caution. So, you know, because like you said, children can't speak, so or at least small babies. Now, mm-hmm. of course, we have all types of kids, right? You know, we don't want to forget the big kids who can't
right.
speak. But, you know, I'd rather see them and know that everything's okay than to miss something or the parent not bring them in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the difference in vital signs between, like, babies and kids and teens and adults?
Oh, well, you know, there are charts and graphs for this, but typically babies, you know, their heart rate is higher, mm-hmm. their respiratory rates are higher, and you
what's
know,
like an average number for that?
Oh, well, it depends upon the kid what we're talking about, but
oh.
say a 12-month-old, I mean, it varies that much, you
yeah.
know, so it really sort of depends, but a 12-month-old baby, you know, heart rate might be around 94.
Mm-hmm.
That would be normal. If it was greater than 100, then I would notice that. and that's called tachycardia. You know, or if they were breathing too fast or greater than 24, that's called tachypnea. So then you're – and again, those things, those vital signs are vital, right? And so they'll let you know that, oh, maybe they have a respiratory issue going on.
Yeah.
Or maybe there's a fever or, you know, maybe there has to be a reason why this is this way.
Yeah.
As you work with adolescents, what are the common conditions, diseases, problems that you – medical problems that you may see at the adolescent population?
Hmm. They're an interesting group. Love the adolescents. I do enjoy them. But, you know, again, most kids are healthy, which we try to encourage. Now, well, this in this day and age, you know, we have some adult illnesses that happen in adolescence because our food is not as healthy as it should be or if we're not exercising as much. So, you know, I might I spend a lot of time talking about nutrition, right? Cholesterol. We start actually checking lipid panels and blood sugar numbers in the adolescent years. So, you know, and sometimes we find high cholesterol. So I could be talking about that. Of course, grade performance or school performance. Sometimes there's behavioral issues. I mean, it's a difficult time of life.
Mm-hmm.
I talk a lot about or, you know, these are the – when I say I talk a lot about, these are the issues that parents are bringing to me as well. You know, attention, maybe concerns about either, like, say, behavioral issues or attention deficit. And there's a lot of conversations about that. And then, of course, healthy kids are healthy, and my goal is to keep them healthy. So it's all about educating about all the common things that can go wrong. So, you know, I'm talking about vaccinations – and being safe and not hanging out with people that are doing things that are not healthy, like smoking cigarettes or, you know, we want to guide people in the right direction and working hard at school and sports and athletics.
What vaccinations do you recommend for adolescents?
Oh, for adolescents. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a booster shot that everybody needs, you know, at the age of 11 or 12, which most people know about. They call that the seventh grade shot, but the diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis booster. But the other important ones that come up at this age are the Menoctra vaccine, which is to help to protect against meningitis. And that's very important, and especially as people are around a lot of other folks and going towards college, you got to get that, or that's very, very important. And then another very interesting one but important one for both boys and girls is the Gardasil vaccine or the HPV vaccine, which helps to protect against cervical cancer, you know, so we're really talking about the future protection. And actually, squamous cell cancers on for the males. So that's very important, and that takes education and time.
Do you find that your patients are receptive to that? Do you have a lot of patients that get that back?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And it is a process. You know, sometimes if they're reluctant, at least they know about it. And I say, well, I want you to think about this. Go home and study about it, and we'll talk about it next time. Or you can always call and come back sooner. But most people are, when I educate that, wow, this is a vaccine that's not just preventing illness, but preventing cancer.
Yeah.
And we're not – I'm not talking about today. That doesn't mean that I'm saying that your kids are doing anything today that's not right. But I'm talking about 5 or 10 years from now. Parents understand that.
Good.
Most of the time. Yeah.
Okay.
And it's always a choice, of course. They get to have a choice. But most of them, they're very open to that, protecting their kids in that way.
What about peanut allergies? Are they as severe as well, I know they used to be extremely severe. Have they improved at all? What's the status of that?
Oh, gosh. They can be just as severe, of course.
And,
you know, then it's just –
it just seems like we've become more sensitive to them. You know, and I just wondered if that had an impact at all.
Not that I've seen. I mean, maybe if you're talking to an allergist, you know, who specializes in that. But otherwise, I think that we do a pretty good job of avoiding that exposure in school. I know even for my own kids, it's like that's the one thing you know you cannot send to school, you know, for a snack for anybody, you know.
Right.
So I think we do a pretty good job. And otherwise, they have the epinephrine pens and do a good job. So I don't come across that as being a major issue that I encounter frequently.
Okay.
Yeah.
My mom's friend's daughter. She's just turned one a couple months ago, and she ended up going to the hospital for, like, irregular breathing. And they said basically what she has is asthma, but she's not technically old enough to be diagnosed with asthma. So, like, what would that be?
Well, we'd call that reactive airway disease, so which is another term for asthma. But, you know, to make the diagnosis of asthma, it takes having wheezing or respiratory issues, tachypnea, breathing fast is what that means, on three or more occasions. So she's 12 months. That's the first time that's happened.
Well, she's about a year and a half. So.
Okay. But if that was the first time it happens, they're basically what they're saying is it looks like she might have asthma, but we'll have to watch and see if this is a pattern.
Okay.
And many children, small children, especially those under the age of two, but under the age of two or three, when they get a common cold, often will wheeze, get some wheezing. So you have to treat them with the same medicines that you use for that reactive airway disease. For asthma, you use the same medicines. And it might just be a one-time occurrence or only when they get sick, or they might really have asthma, and there's different degrees of asthma as well. So you just sort of have to wait and watch and see what their pattern is before you give that diagnosis and put that on their medical history list.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens and other interested folk. This edition is a special program, Rap with a Pro. We're featuring pediatrician Dr. Mignon. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. Joining me at the round table, I welcome Holly Berger. Holly is a student at Rickards High School. She's a regular. She's in the Millicent Hollifield Health Academy, and she's interested in either being a pediatrician or a gerontologist. We also have Dr. Mignon Emenike. She is with the Health and Wellness Center of North Florida, and she is our feature professional today. So thanks for joining us, Dr. Mignon. We were just talking about asthma, and I wanted to ask you, why do we see so much asthma? Asthma seems to be on the increase. And wanted to know the connection or the relationship with asthma and secondhand smoke.
Yes, there's a very strong relationship there. Pollutants in the air, secondhand smoke exposure for sure. And also, you know, not just secondhand smoke, cigarette smoking, which I always educate parents is not a good thing. And it also increases the risk for otitis media for children. And it's not good for the person who's smoking either. That's right. Also, you know, environmental pollutants in the air. So the quality of our air is an issue as well. And that can exacerbate asthma.
Yep. Can you tell us about the treatment of asthma? And I guess including the stages that the asthmatic experiences. That makes sense?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Okay. Yes, asthma is interesting, and we're doing a better job in general of treating asthma, but there's still a lot of undertreated asthma, and especially for children, because kids have such a great reserve, and of course, they're not going to tell you, oh, my chest feels tight. You know, they're so healthy that their body can compensate. But the problem is if you undertreat it, you'll have scarring in the lungs over time. And, you know, you can have chronic lung disease as an adult because it was untreated when you were a kid. So it's very important to treat that and diagnose that. A lot of people believe, you know, so there's different stages. I'll get back to the treatment as I'm talking about the stages. Okay. There's different stages, mild, moderate, severe. And, you know, there's different types of medicine. So there's albuterol or an inhaler, which is the type of medicine that treats your asthma acutely. So when you're feeling tight or wheezing. And people are familiar with that. But then there's also there's the steroid inhalers or the prophylactic medicine to help to stabilize and control your symptoms, and you got to take those every day. The most important thing, or one of the challenges, can be that when you get the asthma under control and people are taking it every day and then their symptoms go away, they think, oh, I'm better. I don't need this medicine anymore. And so they stop taking that. Or maybe they just don't understand, oh, you meant you wanted me to take this every day. You know, so it's you know, something that's a learning process. And I really have to focus on educating people repeatedly and making sure that they understand, now, this medicine, I want you to take it every day, twice a day. This is what is going to stabilize your child. And hopefully what you'll find is that you don't need to use the albuterol.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. And then what I tell people, and it's important for the listeners to know, is that if you need your albuterol inhaler more than twice a week, then you need to be on a daily prophylactic medication. So often my question to the parents is, well, how often are you giving the albuterol or this, you know, inhaler? And they'll say, oh, I give it every day. Well, that's a problem. That means that it's not well controlled. Or actually, I saw a child just today, and he was following up from the flu last week that he was treated for, but in his baby brother has a nebulizer because he was wheezing. And the little boy was saying, he was seven, you know, I have asthma. And his mom said, no, you don't. And the boy said, yes, I do. I cough every time I run on the playground. And I'm thinking, he's absolutely correct. You know, sometimes you don't wheeze, you just cough with exercise. So exercise-induced asthma, or sometimes you just have a nocturnal cough or a cough when you're running or when you get a cold or when the weather's cold. So he was actually right. And amazing. Yeah. So, and of course, his mom didn't think that he was sick with asthma, and we never gave him that diagnosis. So, so it was interesting, and it's just important for people to know, and you have to take the time to educate people as to what it really is, so that you can treat it properly, and how important compliance and consistency is.
You mentioned that you often talk about nutrition with your patients and their parents. Just how important is nutrition? And I say this thinking about the obesity rates that we're seeing. Would you address that?
Oh, yes. I mean, that is huge. Mm-hmm. Food is medicine, right? And or, you know, if it's trash and that's what we're eating, you know, I always say, you know, the color of a Cheeto, that's not a natural orange. You know, that really is not supposed to be in our body. Food is energy. And if the quality of the food is not good, then, you know, that's what we're feeding our brain and our fat cells and our body cells, which is then getting stored as fat. And it's addictive, and it's not optimal for going to school and thinking and taking your test every day. Mm-hmm. So we talk about it a lot. Now, of course, you know, sometimes people say that healthy food is expensive.
And
it is more expensive. Cheap food is – it's cheap, and it's not really good for you. So,
and in certain neighborhoods, you don't even have healthy food available.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, true. You go to the store, and there's nothing fresh.
Yep, that's the truth. Yeah. That's the truth. Or people come in, you know, with their bag of, you know, potato chips or McDonald's from across the street. And you know, the chill – what I tell them is that – even though it's an effort and change is not easy, and it's, you know, changing your palate and changing your behavior, that the children can only eat what the parents bring in the house. And if the kid's cholesterol is high or their blood sugar is high, and if their mom is overweight, I might have to say, hey, look, you know, this isn't going to help just him. It's going to help you too, you know. And if you have a sweet tooth and this is what you're bringing and then you're telling them not to eat this – that's going to be real hard for a kid to do. So it's an eye-opener and an education for the whole family. And, you know, it doesn't usually happen overnight, but, you know, we're trying to help people, and some people will listen, and we just keep trying.
What impact does culture have on your treatment?
Oh, well, that's interesting. I think in terms of the treatment, it's probably not any different, but it's in terms of the education and the communication, and really, you know, making people, one, feel that you're comfortable and that you understand, and also helping them to understand most people want to do well. Everybody, mm-hmm. most people, everybody wants to live and be happy and live a long, happy, healthy life. And if you take the time to, you know, speak that language and say it in a way that they understand, you know, they usually get it and they want to try. But it's very important. I mean, mm-hmm. it's extremely important because I have patients come all the time from maybe they've gone to another facility or the emergency room, or it's not a good feeling when you feel like someone doesn't listen or they weren't hearing me. So being able to take the time to do that is very, very powerful for me, and it facilitates that relationship and it encourages the patients to follow what I'm advising them to do.
What's the most rewarding part of your job?
Oh, that's interesting. I think for me personally, really making a difference in people's lives and them being appreciative and grateful, and, you know, I become important to the people around me, to my community. And that is personally fulfilling. And I'll never forget once, this was many years ago, but leaving a room and, you know, I'm from Tallahassee. So not only do I see the kids, but some of these kids, you know, I went to school with their parents, mm-hmm. you know, or I might take care of my friend's parents or grandparents. And it was pretty cool to walk out of a room and I didn't recognize the lady at first, and to hear her tell her daughter, the little pediatric patient, you know, oh, I went to school with your doctor. You know, it's satisfying to know that you come back and do good things. So that's great. And, you know, I'm going to take care of people well, especially when I know that they knew me before or they can call me and say something to me, like, you know, do a better job. You know, I don't ever want to hear that. So unfortunately, I haven't had to hear that. But I do pay attention to it.
What about teen parenting? What's the status of that adolescent pregnancies?
Teen parents?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Do you see them?
Yeah, we have some young parents. Mm-hmm. We have some teen parents who, you know, go to different schools, and there's mm-hmm. programs for the children, mm-hmm. babies.
Exactly.
They take them to school, and a lot of teen parents, and they might also live with their parents.
Mm-hmm.
So young moms who, you know, when I ask who's at home, it's, oh, my mom and my dad. Mm-hmm. And it just takes a lot of, again, it takes a lot of time and education of those teen parents because they're young and inexperienced and they may not know what to look for the babies. And then there's a lot of teen parents who are really with it. You know, they come in with their partners and they impress me, or they come in with their moms and they're on it. So, in fact, I think most of my teen parents are very capable. You know, mm-hmm, once they mm-hmm. get faced mm-hmm. with that challenge, they rise to the occasion and do what they need to do for their baby.
As we talk about adolescents and teens, one of the issues that often arises is the sleep, or the lack of it, that you find occurs during adolescence. How important is sleep? And do you see any sleep deprivation or problems in the adolescents that you treat?
Sleep is very important. I talk a lot about sleep. I personally haven't noticed it to increase in adolescence mm-hmm. for me. Although I do talk about sleep with all my patients because it's crucial. You know, your body needs time to rest and rehabilitate and regenerate and recuperate before you get up and go to school and do everything else that you need to do. But there are people with sleep problems for sure. And going to bed on time, sleeping in darkness, turning off the television, not having a TV in your room
mm-hmm.
is very, very important. And then there are people who have sleep difficulties, especially those with attention deficit disorder, which can be a challenge for young kids. There are some children who will stay up until 1 or 2 o'clock at night. I mean, it's a real problem.
Yeah.
And then we, you know, there are, you know, one of my first recommendations is melatonin, or the night spray that you can use under the tongue that works well and it's natural and it sort of takes the edge off and helps them to settle themselves. So we do talk about that and the ways to treat that or deal with that, because it's difficult for the parents because they're exhausted. I mean, some parents, the babies have difficulty sleeping or the children.
Indeed.
And meanwhile, the adult parent is tired and she needs to go to bed so she can get up and go to work.
So sleep is significant, is what you're saying.
Oh, very, very.
In addition to exercise. We haven't talked about exercise.
Yeah. Well, and the basics, which is, you know, whether you're a child or an adult. I mean, these are the things that are going to keep you healthy, well, and live a long life and with good quality is it's, you know, eating right, exercising, sleeping, you know, stress reduction too. But you can do a lot with food, you know, proper nutrition and exercise and sleep, of course. But
you know, I know indeed you are quite right, but we live in a society that's in just about in opposition to all those things. So it's very difficult for teens particularly to get the adequate amount of sleep, nutrition, and exercise.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it seems like that particular population has a difficult time.
Yeah. It's true. But if we can, if you know, once they're aware, hopefully, because it's only going to get harder. I mean, that challenge is never going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a work in progress. I always say it takes practice. But also, the sooner we start practicing some of those things, sleep is not so difficult if we just make a schedule and turn off the lights and get in bed. I mean, you know, there is homework and those types of things that we have to do. But there are some behavioral things that we can do to make it better. But it takes practice. And that's the same discipline that's hard for adults.
I mean,
it's the same conversation, you know. But the sooner you learn it, or at least try it, the better.
Energy, we're running out of time, and I have a list of things that folks have said. Find out about energy drinks. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about energy drinks?
I don't feel good about them. That's the answer to the question. I'm not with it.
Great.
Yeah, it's no good. Go to bed. If you need energy, go to sleep.
Okay.
There you go.
Yeah, but they're everywhere. And seems like everybody. Have you ever had one?
I have, but not often. Like, I'll have one every once in a while. But it's not so much for energy as it is for taste. But, I mean, I can understand having energy drinks if, like, you're on a long drive, like, over Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
Like, driving for a long time. I can understand having an energy drink if you're really tired or, like, big thing coffee. But just having them all the time, like a lot of people do.
It's not okay. It drains your body, actually. Mm-hmm. It hurts your – if you're drinking those types of stimulants all the time, it actually – it's hard on your adrenal glands and your cortisol levels. So, yeah, it's not a healthy thing to do.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, Holly, because I know several teams that seem to live on those energy drinks. They're drinking them every time I see them. They have an energy drink in their hand.
It's very unfortunate.
They
sell that stuff at the store,
right,
you know, just
everywhere.
Next to the cash register.
Right.
It's sad. Yeah, it's not a good thing.
I've never had one, but you said you drank it for the taste. How do they taste? Yeah. Are they better than?
It's kind of like a soda, but it's got more like, I don't really know how to describe it.
I just wondered. I've never had one, so I don't know what they taste like.
I don't know how to describe it. I've only ever had a couple. Like, Monster is pretty much the only thing I've ever drank in, and, like, I've only had a couple, so, like, every once in a while.
Mm-hmm. Well, I got to jump back to two more questions. One was, when do you think a child should be exposed to swimming? You know, that's been a controversial issue. You know, some experts have said, you know, expose your child to swimming 6 months. And we know one of the big problems is them swallowing water. So I'm asking that. Someone asked me to ask you, be sure to ask.
Well, oh, goodness, that's an interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about really about swimming for infants.
Mm-hmm.
There are certified infant, I can't remember the mnemonic for it, but there are certain swim instructors who are certified to teach small babies how to swim. And there is they teach them how to float and how to be safe. That's the most important. They teach them how to turn over and float to the side. They're not you know, they might swim to the edge, mm-hmm. perhaps, but we're not talking about swimming at age
right.
for fun. I don't, as long as it's done with somebody who's certified, mm-hmm. and I can say that I recall that when my baby, my daughter, who is now 10, was an infant, she took those classes.
Okay.
Yeah. And, okay. And I, you know, I thought it was important. We have a swimming pool, and and she took the classes and did a great job. And, you know, we were there for all of them, and I personally didn't see any problem with that.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you. That's it for this hour. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. This edition of 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Hollifield. Technical assistant, Ken Smith. Audio copies are available. And if you want to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Team Podcast, log in wfsu.org. Check us out on Facebook.